Hello and welcome to this last morning talk of this semester. As the largest startup hub at Aarhus University, the Kitchen is dedicated to assisting students and researchers in realizing their inner entrepreneur. Whether you're looking to test a business idea or accelerate an existing startup, we're here to support you every step of the way. Morning Talk with the Kitchen is a live event with insightful discussions with entrepreneurs about their journey to creating a successful startup. The discussions will be filled with experiences and the highs and lows of the entrepreneurial process. My name is Sina and I am the Head of Branding and Events at The Kitchen. In this episode, we sat down with Simon Milgaard, CEO of Titotropics. Titotropics is a biomedical company that develops new treatments for patients with neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's and Huntington's disease. Our discussion explores how Simon raised over 220 million Danish crowns for his company, and we dive into which tools that have been the most valuable on his journey from researcher to entrepreneur.
Now I'm going to take the other set of papers.
Good morning, Simon and Laurie. Welcome to the kitchen.
Thank you for inviting me.
Can you introduce yourself and your background?
Yes, so my name is Simon Milgaard. I'm here from Aarhus University, did my master's and my PhD at Aarhus University in molecular biology, or moved to medicine to do my PhD in neuroscience. So that's my background.
Yeah, and you're the co-founder of Titotropics.
Yes.
And this is like, you have to give us a pitch now, and it has to be a pitch if there are people here with like different from your background. If your mom was sitting out there, like how would you explain what it is Titotropics does?
Sure. So back at university, we used to work on understanding what makes the brain young, or more precisely, what happens with the brain when it gets old. So in principle, the blueprint we get from our parents is the same, sort of very simplistically speaking at least, but something happens in the brain as we age, that means that the brain stops working as well as it did, and for some people that also translates into what is called neurodegenerative diseases such as Parkinson's, Huntington's and Alzheimer's. And we try to understand the biochemistry of what is it in a brain that makes it young and what is it that makes it old. And while we're discovering work on this, we discovered a novel mechanism for how brain cells keep each other alive. And through an extensive process, we realized that we could actually sort of kick off this event in a brain cell. So even that it was aging, even though it was undergoing degeneration, we could actually restart the system and make the neuron work as if it was young again. And that is what we've developed into a compound that we are now bringing forward in Titor.
Yeah, and who can this potentially help?
So we are working on, we are going to test first in human next year, so pretty far in the process already. And the aim is to treat Huntington patients and Parkinson patients. So we are developing an injection, so once weekly, a subcutaneous injection that will then, for this peptide, go to the brain and start these signaling events so we can stop further progression of these diseases. Unfortunately, for Parkinson and Huntington, what happens is that the neurons die, and that is the reason why you develop these symptoms, and ultimately these are fatal. So we can't resurrect neurons that are already gone, but our ambition is to treat as early as possible to prevent these from developing the major effects of the diseases.
And the market currently, like what is out there already?
So for Huntington patients, there are no treatments available. Some have some symptoms treatment, but it's very few. The side effects of these are quite severe, require psychiatric monitoring when you get these symptoms treatment, so there is nothing for these patients. And it's around 80,000 people in the US and EU that are suffering from Huntington.
He must feel very like privileged to wake up every morning and this is the mission that you're on. Yeah.
Yes, but certainly also some pressure to get this moving forward.
Completely right.
Yeah.
And besides you in Titotropics, who are the team today?
So I did my postdoc in the lab of Simon Glerup, and together with Anders Dalby and Matthias Ollendorf, we worked on this project and we spun out as the four co-founders in 2020.
Yeah, and you have a number of employees right now as well,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, we are growing. So we were sort of born into a COVID period, so we did a lot of the work virtual, and that has sort of translated into the way we work. But as we are progressing, we have hired a few more people. So, but we are still, I mean, eight people work in the company, and I think, I just checked yesterday, I think we're close to 40 consultants that work in the company as well. So a lot of managing consultancy hours and so on is the way we do it.
Interesting. Mm. So, Simon, every entrepreneurial journey is very different. Some are born entrepreneurs and know, like, okay, from the moment they get out of the womb, they know I'm going to do this. And others, and that's actually not most people, on compared to what people otherwise believe. But how did your like journey in entrepreneurship begin? It was something about a love of patterns.
So when I started at the university, I have this drunk moment with one of my my buddies. At a Friday bar, we were discussing why we started studying molecular biology. And I mean, it's always been sort of the ambition to do something good for some people suffering from diseases. If you could just be a tiny fraction of improvement, that would be worth all of it.
Yeah.
So that was my ambition. I mean, I think when you study, you think that's probably too far-fetched. But then when I started my PhD, actually, I started at a center called the Mind Center.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized a lot of the students there had patents already. And then I realized that I mean, patents are science that has a commercial value as well. So I think that's the difference between a publication and a patent, that you actually get the opportunity to take your science into a setting where it could be beneficial for patients. So that, in principle, that's the same with the articles when you publish, but this is sort of a piece of paper saying that this has commercial value. So I thought that should be my ambition during my postdoc years, at least, develop something that could be patentable and relevant for patients. So I don't love writing patents. That's that's a tough word, but I mean.
Anybody beside patent lawyers, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
So when you like got on that path, like where did that take you? It took you to Simon Gleop, and just to anyone who doesn't know who Simon Gleop is, can you just?
Yeah. So Simon was actually my co-supervisor at my PhD, and I enjoyed working with him. So when I started my postdoc, I started in his lab, and I think together with one other person, we were the first people in his lab. So he was also setting up his own lab, and so Simon, he's a associate professor, I think.
At
biomedicine, and he's probably one of the most entrepreneurial people at Aarhus University, especially at biomedicine. So
there's a myth that he has raised like a billion.
It's getting close.
Yes.
So he started more or less at the same time. He started two other companies, one called Draupnir, which then worked with cholesterol lowering medicine, and one called Muna Therapeutics, which is a big company now raising or working on different projects, but in the neuroscience space as well. So we did have some. I mean, he hasn't worked in Tytor because he's worked in the Muna, but I mean, he's been an integral part of the journey to get the Tytor up and running.
Yeah, because what did it mean? Like, I remember you told me that, like, okay, so he actually gave you the freedom to explore.
But also thinking in that mindset of entrepreneurship, because I mean, we did basic science, and when you do basic science, it's not like a compound drops in your lab in the middle of an experiment, right? You have to think in those lines of what can this eventually translate into, and how would this benefit people? And I think that's not something we are educated at university during our. I mean, I know there's entrepreneurship studies also at PhD school now and so on, but there wasn't anyone when I was doing my PhD. So just given that mindset of thinking, could this be a drug potentially? I think that's what he's really good at, seeing a potential.
And you ended up getting a patent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how, like, so there's actually a lot of patents being made out there that never goes anywhere.
Mm.
Yeah, but what happened when you got this?
Yeah, so the patent we filed was also a bit early in the development, so that was an issue down the line. But when we filed the patent, I decided to go to a competition in London to join up for that. It was a pharma company and an investor that set up a competition. So we went, and you got to pitch for a lot of people, and that was interesting. It's a different kind of pitching than you do, or presentations you do when you present normal science. But then we got these mentors, and I got one from a big pharma company called Johnson & Johnson, and he was a really nice guy. They worked with, at least with, some of the same mechanisms that we work with, so he invited me to Belgium to come and visit their site and present to some of the people down there, which I said yes, thank you, and went to Belgium. And I mean, when we were sort of discussing and planning the meeting, I realized that they're taking this seriously. But I think I should have sort of understood how seriously they were taking it, because when I got there in the airport, there was a limo driver waiting for me. And when I got to the hotel, he said, if you need anything, I'm outside waiting for you. I was like, that was a bit bit strange. And then when I got to the meeting, they had invited all the executives from the development branches. So the people that were worrying about commercialization of products and safety and so on. And we were nowhere near having a product that was relevant for any of these people. So it was a 2-hour meeting, and 5 or 10 minutes into the meeting, one of the guys especially, he was quite mad that I was wasting his time. So that was a strange experience, but it was a good discussion. They invited us actually to be a part of the incubator in Belgium. We said no thank you. It seemed like a big step to move a very early program to a pharma incubator at that time. But nonetheless, we knew that there was some interest in the biology. We were far away from being relevant to pharma yet, but what we were doing could potentially have some impact for people. So I think even though it was a strange experience, it was also something that really gave us the confidence that we were on the right track.
Yeah, there was something really, yeah. Really there.
Yeah.
Usually when we talk about the world of academia and the world of entrepreneurship, we usually highlight all the differences that there are. But you also told me there are actually some things that you think that you've taken some skills that you've acquired within academia that you can use, and one of them is driving a process.
I mean science is a bit similar, at least in the beginning of companies. I mean, you have to have visions for what you're doing, why you're doing it, and be diligent in the science and plan ahead. So so all those skills and traits were something that you can use in a biotech as well. You do science a bit differently, at least when you get a bit further, but the diligence and the thoroughness of science should be what sort of emanates your company still.
Yeah, because you also said like, okay, so we're nothing without research. You said like the strive for excellence in many ways.
I think that's certainly what has helped us on our path, that we've been very, very thorough with our science. So sometimes it takes a bit more time, but ultimately that's what investors are looking for, thorough science. So so that's always been the main pillar of Tytour. To be thorough in our science, but also, I mean, we want to be on the front edge of neuroscience. So that also means you have to put a lot of focus on the science part.
Yeah, is there also like a bit of competitiveness in that, like strive to be like?
So I just came back yesterday from a conference, investor conference, and I guess there are 20 slots for each investor. At such a conference, and I heard from one of our investors that he's gotten 270 invites, and that's only sort of those that were relevant to him, right? So, so of course there's competitiveness. I mean, to get the attention. Another example is one of our investors, Industrifonden. They told me that last year they looked at 2,000 cases and invested in 5. So I mean, you have to be a standout company to get that kind of attention, right? Yeah. So, and that requires some presentation as well of your data.
Are there other skills from like academia that you think has been beneficial?
I think one thing that's been really good for us, at least, is you are used to working in a very an environment where things change a lot, and that's certainly also the case when you set up a company. You can have plans. On Monday, you can make plans for the week, and then Monday evening, you have to change them, right? And if you don't like working in that kind of environment, then it's going to be a challenge. But that's because that's how it is. So, and that's if science drives the path, then you can have a result that changes your plans. Yeah. So I think that's been important as well.
Yeah. Now let's talk about some of the skills that you've had to acquire that you didn't really feel like you had in the beginning. Well, you told me that you've always been good at communicating, but you also told me that the ability to take feedback has been crucial.
Yeah, so I don't know if I've always been good at communicating, but you had to learn that at least. So
you told me that they sent you out to science show.
So I
think you must have been above average.
But I mean, I think, it's certainly about communicating, right? You have, I don't know, there's been these studies where they look at how much attention span you have of people when you start talking, right? And it's not a lot, so you have to be quick in making sure that they understand the main point. A normal academic presentation builds up, if it's a 45-minute presentation, it builds up for 35 minutes before getting to the point in the end, right? And you don't have that luxury when you have 10 minutes to present your company. So you have to learn to be precise, and a part of that journey is also to accept that you don't do it correctly in the beginning, and take in feedback from, especially from our consultants, but also investors we talk to. We try to take learnings. I always go back and evaluate after presenting.
Yeah.
What resonated? What kind of questions do I get after a presentation? Because often those questions highlights the weaknesses of your presentation. So building that into each presentation and making sure that next presentation addresses that up front is a way that I've worked on my presentations.
And how is that different from the way that you used to work as an academic?
So when you present to investors, they are looking at the science, but they're also, Løvens Hule has ruined this a bit for us, right? Because you always hear they discuss sort of the valuation and the market potential and so on. Whereas in reality, investors they don't look necessarily at the market potential; they look at the risk ahead.
Yeah.
So everything is an equation of risk versus reward.
Yeah.
And as an example, if there was 100% certainty that if you invested 100 kroners, you would get 102 kroners, everybody would get it.
Yeah.
Would do it, right? If it was 99%. Probably a lot of people would still, but as the percentage drops, at some point the reward has to go up, because otherwise it doesn't make sense to invest those kind of money. And that's the same with investors when they invest in biotech, right? They look at the risk, and in neuroscience the risk is quite high. We are close to 100% failure rate. So that means that the reward has to be big as well, right?
Yeah.
And how do you make sure when you develop your program that you understand those risks? We had a chart, a Word document. 4 pages highlighting all the risks we had ahead, right? And there's a lot. And every investor, everybody who's buying companies, they know that those are there. And if you don't know the risks, then it's just because you don't know them, right? And that's a risk for them as well, that you don't know the risks in your company. So so I think it's more about understanding that part of your company than the Løvens Hule model, or Lion's Den model, where you have.
But you know, in Løvens Hule, they always say, I invest in the person.
Mm.
And there is something about that. You told me that you have to be able to, as you said, take feedback. You have to be good at listening actually to what they're saying.
Yeah.
Because when you go into, especially with funding, if you go into a funding partnership, it is a partnership.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that goes the same. I once talked to an investor who said that he only worked with companies where he could see that even on a personal level, he would go out for a beer with this person.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think even though it's a bit simple, I understand what he's getting at, right? Because you do have to work close together and there will be challenges ahead. So if you are sort of a stubborn, I'm going to be a bit, but a stubborn scientist, we do see them sometimes, right? Then, I mean, it's going to be a challenge when you have your plans and your missions and then something doesn't work and you don't want to change course. They've put in their money, so they also, I mean, I don't know how many people, I certainly didn't know how an investor fund worked before, but they have what is called LPs, which is basically bigger funds in Europe, or rich people in the local area that invest in their fund, and they promise them within 7, 8, 9 years, they'll have a return on their investment. So their own job depends on their ability to make sure that the companies are sold so they can make return on investment, so they can continue working in a fund as well. So they're under the same pressure as we are. You don't see it at the same level at these meetings, but they have the same people behind them nagging about what's going on, why aren't you selling companies and stuff. So for them, it's also to make sure that the companies they invest in are actually companies that can progress. And part of that is a good relationship working together.
Yeah.
And as we talked about also, I think sort of a classical way of looking at it is to say that science is science. It can only go to a certain level. So if the science is not good enough, it will never be a product on the market. Whereas a team, you can always change. If the science is there, you can find the people that can bring it to the utmost potential. But the science is something you can't change. So that's why they look more at the team, I guess, than...
So when you told me there was a very steep learning curve in terms of like learning all this business lingo that you just talked about, but in contradiction to many of the other researchers I talked to who was told like how difficult it was, you said it was difficult as well, but you felt like it was just something that had to be done.
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to that Friday bar discussion, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I always wanted to pursue something that could change the lives of some people, and this felt like a natural course for a program with potential to actually help patients suffering from very severe diseases. So, so there's no funding opportunity basically for where we were at with the program. We had an early version of our compound, and we wanted just to do studies to make it the compound better, basically. And that's not something we can publish. So there was no funds available, sub-funding at university level. So the only way to develop the program was to set up a company where we could get funds for activities like that.
But how was it? Like, I guess if when you started this journey, like you had an academic career perhaps inside. And how was it to like start something that was just completely out of your ball game in many ways?
Amazing. I think it was. I've loved every second since as well. I thought it was amazing to.
Was that a surprise that it was like that it was so interesting?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this is going to sound a bit silly now, but we still high five in the offices when we have great science coming out of the lab. So I mean I just think that's an amazing thing to be a part of something where you are. You're pioneering new biology. One thing is that we're developing a drug against this, but also we are discovering new biology, how the brain works, and I think that's an amazing thing to be a part of. And that's a different pace in a biotech company. So we got the 10 million kroners from BI. I know you're going to talk a bit later about that as well, but that allowed us to accelerate things. I mean, we have to spend 10 million in 1.5 years, two people, so that requires to sort of pick up the pace, right? Do expensive stuff quickly.
And some of the expensive stuff were mice. I remember you told me, it's like, it's for mice.
Yeah. Yeah, some of these mice are really expensive, actually. Yeah. But but I mean, I think every aspect of it, the way you do science, sometimes we do things in parallel, whereas in academia, you do one thing, but we need to test both of them because basically what drives the value of our company is how many years our patents have left when we get approval on the market for Huntington. The estimated price for there's no products on the market now, but the estimated price or annual revenue on a program in Europe and US is around $8 billion. So it's evident that if we can get to market 6 months before, it doesn't matter if we spend 100 million more to get the half a year faster, because the revenue is going to be significantly higher in the end. So that means that sometimes you do things in parallel. Maybe they will give the same result. That's what we're hoping for, at least. But you would normally do them staggered in academia because it's just so expensive. So those kind of science things have changed, but science is still science. So
science is still science. Yeah. And you smile. Yeah. Isn't it weird, like those numbers when you juggle them around? Yes. Isn't it really weird?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, and you get when you get sort of prepared for clinic, you start hiring consultants that have salaries that just doesn't make sense. So we just have to sort of embrace that and just say, okay, that's how it is, right? But it's just, I mean, that's also sometimes when we talk to IT companies, for instance, that are really successful, the money we raise are quite significant compared to IT companies as well. But that's because most of their expenses comes from salaries, where we buy a lot of out-of-house work and clinical studies as well. So, so that's just more expensive. Hence the higher numbers.
Now you talked a bit about it already, but the perks of entrepreneurship, or the perks of what it is that makes it so great. Like you told me, if you won 10 million, you would still like go to work on Monday and be like so happy about it. What is it that makes it great?
Well, I think
the purpose.
I think it's really. I think it's several things. It's the purpose. It's certainly also the science, but I just think it's right now we're on a path, on a mission to help help patients and do something novel. And I think that's worth every minute and every hour we can put in it.
Is it because it's? I guess you have very changing tasks as well. You actually told me that you're not like have your hands in the research anymore.
No.
Like you're managing those 40 consultants. But it's a very changing, I guess, schedule. Yeah.
Yes, but after we raised our Series A, I can also, I mean, I think prior to that, I was probably more sort of a group leader with extended responsibilities a bit more. I guess I mean more financing and stuff than you have at university, of course. But after we sort of developed and are developing towards clinic, my role has become much more management and finances.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So that has really changed a lot. And that is a very sort of changing environment, I have to say.
And is that fun?
Yeah, I was a bit.
You were a bit nervous, right?
Yeah, so I like basic science a lot, mm-hmm. and I like to be part of that. And my new role involves a lot of discussions on the clinical part.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, which is a good thing, but there's a lot of work in the regulatory aspect, getting all the documents to the authorities, but also GDPR. I mean, how do you handle patient data and all that stuff? And I was a bit sort of anticipating how I'd react to being part of that instead of basic science. But I have to say also, I love that part as well. I think it's amazing to be part of those discussions. So,
if somebody had told you that 5 years ago, would you have believed them?
Probably not to the extent that, but I think it's the development of the program is where it's at now means that that's a natural next step as well. So, yeah.
So you have a team, as you told beforehand, and there are many stories about how you form a team. And how was yours formed? Like you were, just because I know that you said you met each other on the PhD, but I've written something about a Christmas lunch.
Yeah, so so I started on this project as a postdoc in the lab of Simon Glerup, and Matthias, he was still at high school when he started, so he had the best student job. He went up to do behavioral work on the mice.
Yeah.
So he would go up, set up the mice for an experiment, then we'd go back to the offices and do all his homework for next day at high school. And sometimes he would come after a Friday bar, sleep on the couch in the office, and then do the lab work in the morning. So he had a really great job. And one time he was part of the Biomedicine Friday bar, and he brought Anders along because they were good friends from high school. And Matthias was talking to a girl, so me and Anders ended up talking, and we just hit it off. And he did his bachelor in the lab of Poul Nissen, but they wanted to do more neuroscience, so he came over, and the rest is history, as they say.
Why, like, you told me that's one of the advices that you have as well, to, like, form a team.
Mm.
Why is that? Besides that you have somebody to high-five besides yourself, which is a perk. Yeah.
I mean, being completely alone is difficult, right? There's so much work to be done, both in the company development and in the science. And from the beginning, we did a split. So Anders did all the science work, and I did all the outreach and company building and so on. So that allowed us to focus a bit more, I think. But also, it's nice to have other founders as well, I think, for the process.
Yeah, because you are, I guess, you told me that when you are a team of founders, you just have that passion. In a different, like, you need that passion. Yeah. You need that as a fuel. Yeah.
Yeah, because when you, I've been to many of these presentations before, and you always sit and hear this person talk about a successful journey, right? But it's not very often you talk about all the bumps you had on the road, right? And we had a lot of bumps as well, where things are tough. Mm-hmm. We had.
Yeah, it was like, tell us about a bump. We want to hear about.
Yeah. So we coming out of BII, we. We did a lot of interesting science, and we talked to a lot of investors, and what you'll hear from investors is, this is really interesting, come back when you have this data. And they'll say that forever. If you bring back that data, they'll ask you for new data. So that's the biggest challenge for companies coming out, I think, from BII, right? That making that transition into fully funded company is challenging. They were asking us for more in vivo data, more animal data in models of these diseases. We didn't have the money to do that.
No.
So what you need is to find an investor who believes enough in that to actually do that. And we were running on the fumes. I think we had 2 months left.
Yeah.
Right. And then we got a convertible loan from Sunstone.
Yeah.
So a convertible loan means that it's a loan into the company. When you get a big investment or when there's a valuation of the company, that converts into shares instead of having to pay it back. And they come with all kinds of not very nice clauses and stuff, but that's just the way it is. That allows us to do some of the work, and things were, I mean, we got great data. We had the runway, I think we extended the runway 6 months, and we spent 4 months doing the work, so we had 4 months left. And by the end of these results, we had interest from some of the biggest investors in Europe. So what we were trying to build was what is called a syndicate. So that's a group of investors that together can bring in all the money that's required for developing the next step. And things were looking good. Back then we were trying to raise 20 million euros. So we started talking to some of the bigger funds, and they had an idea of an even bigger investment round. So they wanted to build a sort of a bigger company, bring in new projects into our company. So they were thinking about 60 million euros investment into the company, which, I mean, in principle, it's good to have two competing syndicates, because then you get to negotiate a bit of the deal as well. But what happened was that we ended up in a situation where we didn't have enough investors for the 20 million round, and we didn't have enough investors for the 60 million round. So both actually collapsed. And that happened in the summer of 2022. We were back to scratch. Yeah. We spent 2 years fundraising and trying to bring these investors together. Mm. And now we had 4 months left, right? So yeah. So at that point, you sort of thought, this is, we used all the money to try to persuade these investors, right? We've talked to all of them. And yeah. So that was sort of a way you had to pick up again and really do some outreach.
How do you navigate? Like, because that's one of the main differences between researchers and students as well. Mm. Like, we have families, you know, or we, and I'm not a researcher, but, you know, we have families, we have like some loans that need to be paid for, like,
same. How do
you, adult shit.
If you do what you like, you'll become good at it, and then I'm sure there'll be another job if it fails. I mean, the learnings you do from this, you can use somewhere else. So I'm not too worried about that aspect.
And you shouldn't be either, people. Just need to get started.
Yeah. And if sort of being the devil's advocate, staying at Aarhus University is not easy either. Oh. Right? That has an expiry date as well.
Better build your own exit instead of just waiting for it to happen.
Yeah, that was an opportunity at least. But
Do you have any advice out there if there are any prospering entrepreneurs out there?
Yeah, just to quote Nike, just do it, I think. I mean, it's always difficult because you also have to love that part of it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, of sort of a more changing everyday routine.
Yeah.
But for me personally, I would rather sit 10 years from now having tried and failed than looking back saying this could have been an opportunity I never took a shot at.
Yeah.
So I think that would be my advice at least.
Yeah. And you also told me this, I'm trying to make him say something that's really important for this house, that you shouldn't wait until like it's perfect. Like you have a complete like scope of stuff.
No.
Yeah.
We certainly didn't.
No. You went to Belgium and pitched. And
yeah. And I mean, you will. Yeah. You have to be more direct with investors. Investors are also more direct with you. Mm. So you have to also accept that sometimes you get feedback you don't like and take that in. But that's to help. And then you can advance the program, come back and say, I told you so.
Yeah.
Right? And go for it, I would say.
Yeah. And if anybody wants to go for it, people, you know where to come. So let's give Simon a warm applause for his information.
This was our last morning talk with The Kitchen this semester. You can look forward to more exciting startup stories from us in the fall of 2024.